Ahoy.
Hello.
And welcome to Policy Voices by Friends of Europe, an independent think tank with a difference. Each week from Brussels, we bring you powerful conversations with policy voices from around the world. Policy voices talking policy choices.
Violence against women is one of the detrimental aspects that prevents equality between women and men, that reinforces the discrimination of women, and is one of the largest human rights violations in the EU. The amount and the percentage of women who dare to report is extremely low. And this is not by chance, it's because they don't trust the system and they don't trust that they will be supported by the system. And there is a big fear that then it goes on the way and it turns into a reality that they will be victimized along the process.
Hello and welcome to Policy Voices, Friends of Europe's weekly podcast on European and global affairs. I'm your host, Katerina Villanova. Exactly 2 years ago, on International Women's Day, the European Commission proposed a EU directive to combat violence against women and domestic violence. This new initiative was groundbreaking because, for the first time, it was proposing a common definition of rape based on consent. But in the end, the justice ministers of France and Germany blocked the inclusion of this clause. The European Women's Lobby has been advocating for EU-wide legislation tackling violence against women for decades. And finally, such a legislation is in the final steps of approval. I spoke to Irene Rosales, Policy and Campaigns Officer at the European Women's Lobby, about the significance of this EU directive, the first comprehensive legal instrument at EU level that tackles violence against women. Here's our conversation.
So we are launching a very special episode today, and as I was thinking about this episode this week, I thought either we can do something uplifting or we can have a reminder of how much work there is to be done, there is still to be done. And a colleague of mine at Friends of Europe actually brought my attention to the EU directive that the European Commission proposed 2 years ago on March International Women's Day. EU directive on combating violence against women and domestic violence. And it was quite groundbreaking because for the first time, it was proposing EU-wide definition of rape, which was based on consent. Can you just to set the scene, tell us why was it so important at the time?
To give you an idea, the European Women's Lobby has been calling for a piece of legislation on violence against women for 13 years. So it comes with a lot of background effort from women's organizations to be sure that the topic of violence against women was taken care of at the highest political level of the EU. So it took us some time to convince the European Commission that there was already a mandate in the EU treaties for them to act against violence against women. So there is the treaties that says that the EU should work to achieve equality between women and men, and that in all activities of the EU, there should be an aim to go for gender equality and to avoid gender inequalities. And violence against women is one of the detrimental aspects that prevents equality between women and men, that reinforces the discrimination of women, and is one of the largest human rights violations in the EU. So we really needed to make the case for this to happen. And it's true that this has happened in a context where the president of the Commission, first women leader of the Commission in very, very long time, for the first time ever, she mentioned the topic of violence against women as one of the top priorities of the EU. So it was a good context to start with. We had started also the process of the EU ratification of the Istanbul Convention at the time. 2 years ago, it was still blocked, but we also managed to achieve this landmark last year. So the EU has acceded the Istanbul Convention, which is this international instrument setting up golden standards for dealing with violence and combating violence against women. So it was a crucial step that the Commission took this initiative. It was like also giving recognition to our demands for so long. And what they were proposing is, for on the one hand, a set of crime harmonization of criminal law when it comes to sexual exploitation and the Eurocrime of computer crime. So it was based on two Eurocrimes that are already in the EU treaties. But they also propose that it's also super important a set of rights for the protection of victims and the supports, and also rules on prevention, which are crucial. And this is for all victims of violence against women and domestic violence, as per the national definitions. So while the proposal of the Commission was on the criminal aspects dealing with female genital mutilation and rape, which is very important and we will talk about it, they also included all the aspects of cyber violence. The package of rights of victims is for all victims of violence and domestic violence. We know at the moment, even though the Istanbul Convention has been in place for a very long time, there are five member states who haven't still ratified the Istanbul Convention and where the situation is very difficult. And even though in those countries that have ratified the Istanbul Convention, the level of implementation is not so harmonious and is not so extensive. At the end of the day, we have a big disparity of the protection of women depending on where you live. So this is something that this directive can try, is setting minimum standards so that at least there are minimum minimum rights to protect women victims, and minimum rights also in terms of what the member states should do to prevent and address the root causes of violence against women. So this is why this directive is so important. Indeed, the Commission listened to our demands when we were saying that sexual exploitation in women, as per the Eurocrime, was also covering the topic of sexual violence and rape. So the Commission was doing all the legal analysis needed to say, like, indeed, there is a ground for us to harmonize the concept of rape based on a consent-based and an affirmative approach to rape, which is the same model as in the Istanbul Convention.
Exactly. I want to stay a bit longer on this topic. So the original proposal of the Commission of 2 years ago indeed proposed that rape is defined with this idea of consent that has to be consent. And surprisingly, there was immense backlash, ultimately, that France and Germany both blocked the passage of this clause. In the end, there was no agreement in the Council. And to note, it would be sufficient for either France or Germany to say yes for this definition of consent-based rape to us. Can you just clarify, for the sake of our listeners, what does this mean in practice? What does it mean to have a rape based on consent, and which is mandated by the Istanbul Convention, and what does it mean when for the countries which don't adhere to this definition?
We did an analysis of the added value of this article on the harmonized definition of rape based on consent. This article is very famous, the Article 5. We saw that...
What is the Article 5?
The Article 5. So it's what it showed is that even though the, as you said, the Istanbul Convention is very clear on the mandate of having a definition on rape based on consent, so it's based on free will in the surrounding circumstances, which I think is important also to say, because sometimes the word consent can be understood differently depending on the cultural background. I think that free will, it's very easy to understand. So this is what we're talking about. We're talking about free will of everyone. In this case, is to understand that the free will of women has to be respected. So this principle in the Istanbul Convention was already there since 2011. The Istanbul Convention entered into force in 2014. So it's long ago that we're talking about this. It's not something that should be surprisingly new at all. But there were still 11 EU member states that had definitions of rape that are mostly based on the use of force, threat, or coercion. So that means that when you are in going to access justice and report, first of all, we know that the amount and the percentage of women who dare to report is extremely low. And this is not by chance. It's because they don't trust the system and they don't trust that they will be supported by the system. And there is a big fear that then it goes on the way and it turns into a reality that they will be victimized along the process. the legislations that are based on forced coercion or threat, they tend to re-victimize more the victim because you need to prove that you have resisted to the rape. So there is a either mostly because of force, it comes into play. So the Court of Human Rights, they have said already a long time ago that these types of legislation, they don't protect adequately enough the autonomy of the victims, in this case, as it is a majority of women. So we know that these models are not working enough. We have there is a big case of dropouts during the judicial process. There is a very small percentage of conviction rates. So these models, they don't work. And what it's in the Istanbul Convention and what Grevio is pushing for is to have an affirmative model to consent that is based on precisely on free will. And so there are some countries who have tried a model of consent based on the no means no approach.
Spain. That's Trixon.
No, Spain is a yes means yes since very recently. But for example, Germany and Austria, they still have this no means no. Czech Republic, they're also turning into this model. So it's based on consent, but it's based on the principle that you still need to say no. And they not necessarily address a very factual and very common human reaction, that is that you paralyze from fear. And it happens to almost 70% of women that in case of a sexual aggression, they paralyze from fear.
And it's also based on the assumption that you need to be in a safe, in an environment that is safe enough to say no as well.
Yes, and it's also in the lack of understanding of the circumstances that are surrounding us. Sometimes it caught you by surprise. There are many rapes and sexual violence that happens also in the context of people that you know, but that doesn't prevent you from feeling and having a real fear of your security and your safety and your sexual integrity. So there is this high percentage of women who freeze, and this is not covered and granted by laws that are based on forced threat or coercion, and not necessarily covered neither by legislation that are based on the no means no approach. So this is something that we were calling for a change, and we know that a directive has also, it's another layer of members' states' obligations. It also comes with access to the Court of Justice, and it also comes to the fact that the European Commission could launch infringement procedures if member states are not complying adequately with the provisions of the Istanbul Convention. But then, as you mentioned, there was a huge backlash against it. We have to say that we launched a very a huge campaign to try to get rape into the directive. And at the very beginning, we started with five member states who were supporting having rape in the directive. So it was Belgium, Greece, Italy, Luxembourg, and Spain. These were the first five member states. They did a declaration when the council proposed to remove the article on rape, saying that they considered that it was a missed opportunity and that it that the EU has obligations to act on this. At the end of our campaign, we managed to have almost 15 member states. That is what you need for the qualified majority. But you need 15 EU member states in favor, plus 65% of the population. And this is where we needed Germany or France to be on our side. And unfortunately, the both ministers of justice blocked this decision.
Exactly, their arguments were they just to justify their decision on legal arguments, namely that because when we're talking about rape, we're talking about criminal law, that it is a matter for the member states. And France also put forward the argument that the new notion of consent would be less protective for victims. And now to ask, what is the European Women's Lobby view on both of these arguments, the legal arguments? Why? How to, would you debunk them? What is your response to them?
So indeed, what we did, because the arguments of France and Germany were also based on the opinion of the legal service of the council that was done at the very early stage of the process, which we didn't agree on. The opinion of the legal of the council was very restrictive. But they were leaving a bit the option to the member states to do this, what they would call extensive interpretation of the Eurocrime of sexual exploitation. We don't consider that it was an extensive interpretation, but the fair one, because there was already a directive on child abuse that was using exactly the same interpretation of the crime, Eurocrime sexual exploitation in children. So there was already a precedent of a directive dealing with child abuse, with child sexual violence, that was in the same direction. So we don't agree with the arguments. What we did was to have our own analysis of the EU legal basis for the article on rape. We got 140 signatures of legal experts all around Europe to say that the legal basis were there. So the legal arguments, they don't seem to match. At some point also, some officials in the government of France said like, well, the definition is not exactly aligned with the Istanbul Convention, which was not true either. The Spanish presidency, they did put the same exact wording as per the Istanbul Convention to try to leave that that legal excuse as well, and it didn't work neither. So I think that there were many legal arguments that were thrown that actually, at the end of the day, are very hypocritical, because both Germany and France are part of the Istanbul Convention. They're parties to it. So they have the legal obligation anyway to implement a consent-based definition of rape in the legislation that is up to the best standards. So this is where the second part of your question comes. What we identify is that, of course, consent-based legislation, also because of what Grevio is saying and also the Court of Human Rights is saying, they work better to protect the sexual autonomy of women. What we know is that there are two examples, especially Sweden has been already, they did a change in legislation some time ago. They did an internal evaluation. And what they saw is that they were starting from a very low percentage of reporting, but they saw an increase of 75% of more women who dare to report. So this means that the legislation, it's helping to have an understanding of what sexual violence is.
Which, to be clear, does not mean an increase in the number of crimes. The crimes were already there.
Exactly. It's just that women
felt more compelled and safe and protected.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We always need to be attentive of how this model and any kind of model will work, because there is always a resistance to... There is the patriarchal system that will always resist, and having the right to sex seems like a very granted right of men, which shouldn't be the case. So I think that there is always a resistance, and it will be expressed in many different ways. So I think that the framework that the Istanbul Convention gives us, and this was also in the directive, of understanding the free will in the surrounding circumstances is very important. So we need to ensure that there is autonomy, that there is mutuality, that there is this free will, because you can't consent because you fear of your life. And this is not consent at the end of the day. So I think that it's always important that we keep an eye on how these frameworks are implemented, but it's a better legal framework, and it's the one that we have from the Istanbul Convention. So we really need to be sure that this is implemented in the best possible way so that women can access justice, and that the experience that they need to live through when they go to find justice and reparation is not another layer of torture. Because we've been listening to survivor stories, and we engage them also for the campaign, and there's stories of re-victimization along the judicial way, how many times they need to tell the story by professionals that are not trained, that are not sensitized, that will ask questions that are not pertinent over and over, very lengthy declarations that you need to do. So there is a whole, that sometimes there is an argument saying like, well, but if we go for a consent model, women will invent rapes and there will be false accusations. So you have no idea how much of a torture it is to go through a trial and to go through a judicial process, how much this is re-victimizing, and it's another form of torture.
And so it's a victim blaming.
Exactly, all the victim blaming's attitude. So I really, I cannot imagine anyone who would invent something like this, knowing that the process that we need to go through is extremely hard on them.
And I have to say, even if a small, teeny tiny percentage of claims of rape are not real, it's not something that is exclusive to rape.
No, it's for all type of crimes.
Any crimes can be, anyone can make false claims of anything. No. That should not put into question both the other 99.5% of victims of
in this
sexual violence.
And but it's funny how women tend not to be believed, you know, how there are these prejudices again about how women would say something but mean something different. All these prejudices about women and gender stereotypes are still very prevalent, and this is how it shows. No?
Exactly. And of course, we've been talking at length about this one specific part of the directive that India did not pass. But nonetheless, this directive is the first comprehensive legal instrument at the European Union level that will tackle violence against women. You explained very well already in the beginning how important it will be once it is passed, but I put the emphasis on once because there's still some work to be done. And keeping in mind that there's almost this deadline, you know, with the elections coming up, there's a rush to get files done, to get files approved, and this directive is not the only one. And also keeping in mind that the next presidency will be of Hungary, and also keeping in mind the shift that we've been seeing in Europe to the far right, elections are coming. How important is it that this directive gets passed now?
It's, for us, it's a key landmark achievement to have had this directive sealed in a deal. But it's the first step. And the negotiating team managed to include a review clause. So all directives can be reviewed afterwards. So we hope that, and the negotiating team, what they included was that the review needs to consider extension of crimes again. So we'll have this opportunity of keep extending the crimes that are covered in the directive. So we will keep pushing for rape to be considered to be part of the directive at some point. But it's also very important to consider other aspects of sexual violence as well that should be covered. We also missed the opportunity of including sexual harassment at the workplace. So there is already legislation on the anti-discrimination in employment at EU level, but it was not included in the directive as a criminal offense, which will be also important to have. There is also the aspect of forced sterilization that was left out. This was a very key demand of the European Disability Forum, because there are still many women who are forced to be sterilized, women with disabilities. So there is still work ahead to do, but we have granted that on the one hand, the EU has recognized that there is competence and that we need a specific instrument to look into violence against women and to support the victims through the process of accessing justice, but also accessing support. So I think that these three elements are very crucial to the directive. And this is also what we will be working on, is to ensure that the implementation is done in the best possible way, that women's organizations are considered, that specific vulnerability factors for this specific crime are also considered. For example, there is a higher risk of facing intimate partner violence if you're pregnant, or if you have done an indication that you want to leave a relationship.
Or if you are economically dependent on your partner.
Exactly. So there are specific factors that don't apply to other crimes that needs to be considered from a gender-sensitive perspective so that you understand the root causes of this problem. So this is the work that we need to do. And indeed, we are sure that this is not going to be a priority of the Hungarian presidency. We have some hopes with the Polish change of government that are moving into the right direction. We heard also that they were keen on supporting, for example, rape to be included in the directive. So there are good trends in there. But indeed, for us, the most important is to ensure that we have these institutional mechanisms to ensure that women's rights and equality is being anchored at EU level. So I think that we have kind of big demands also for the next parliament, but we really need to get first the vote on this directive done in April, and then also to be sure that we go to vote and that we go to vote for women's rights candidates, the candidates that support women's rights. So that is like our big mission as well for these elections.
I feel like you already answered my next question, but I still want to ask you, on this International Women's Day, what are your hopes and expectations or demands for the next commission, for the new MEPs? The European Women's obviously put together a manifesto. If there's anything from that you would like to highlight as what you think should be the immediate priority, if there's only one that you can choose.
I think that indeed we have a whole manifesto. We are calling it Europe at a Crossroads, and it's precisely pointing at what you mentioned. On the one hand, during this mandate, we managed to achieve several key pieces of legislation, also some key pieces of legislation that were blocked during years, like for example, the Women on Boards Directive, which went through this mandate. We have also the Equal Pay Directive. There are some pieces of legislation that has been probably is not coincidental that they have been that this mandate has been quite active. We got also a commissioner on equality for the first time, and we got a strategy on gender equality 2020-2025. So these mechanisms help to ensure that women's rights are anchored at EU level. So I think that this will be our request for the next mandate, together with all the measures that we have in the manifesto. But we need to ensure first that the Commission keeps seeing the mission of gender equality as top priority, as it is mandated in the treaties, but that it reflects in a strategy on gender equality, equality between women and men, so that we can have specific measures as top priority. The Commissioner for Equality needs to be in place. It needs to be a key, strong role. But we need also the Commissioner for Equality to be accompanied by the Council. So one of the elements that was a bit difficult to handle for the Directive on Violence Against Women was that most of the member states, the leading minister was the Minister of Justice and not the Minister for Equality. The exception was probably Spain, and I'm not sure if even any other.
Because it's not a position that exists.
Exactly. In many member states, the Minister for Equality comes along many other issues like social policies. There are many other files that they need to cover. But there is not necessarily a minister that is fully dedicated to
a state of law.
Exactly. So this is what we are calling as well. It's a council formation that it deals only with equality between women and men and women's rights.
And final question before I let you go, because it is International Women's Day, the day we launched this podcast, I wanted to ask you, who are your role models? Who are your feminist idols?
I think that I could give you like famous names. And when I started working at the European Women's Lobby, several years after, I managed to meet Gloria Steinem, for example. She was like, it was an idol for me when I was a bit younger. But now I will really say that I have the pleasure and the privilege to work with a lot of women that are working on frontline organizations, trying to support other women that are victims of violence, women that are working directly, for example, with women in prostitution, with survivors. It's so uplifting and so heartwarming to see their work that I cannot even name one single person, but all these women who are extremely committed to the cause, who are giving you this feeling of sorority and feeling of understanding and caring about each other, it's really what it would be my role model, let's say, you know, like it's a collective woman that we make among all of us. That it's really caring I'm not sure how to put it.
Words, I think you put it really nicely. That was a beautiful note to end today's episode. And thank you so much.
No, thank you. It was really nice.
Thank you for staying on that side and listening to my conversation with Irene Rosales, Policy and Campaigns Officer at the European Women's Lobby, about the importance of the EU Directive on Combating Violence Against Women and Domestic Violence. As always, let us know what you thought of today's episode of Policy Voices. You can search for Friends of Europe on LinkedIn and X or send us an email. Our address is press@friendsofeurope.org. And don't forget to subscribe to Friends of Europe's podcast wherever you get your podcasts to never miss an episode of Policy Voices. I'm Katarina Villanova and I will be with you again next week. Until then, happy International Women's Day.